AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Our mission, as always, is to take a huge stack of complex sources. We're talking history, economics, science, culture, and distill it all into the ultimate knowledge shortcut for you.
We don't just list the facts. We're here to connect the dots, to make sure you walk away with a real deep understanding of the world.
And today, we're undertaking a really massive deep dive. We're looking at a nation that is just full of contradictions.
It really is. It's an undisputed environmental superpower. I mean, truly world leading. But it's also endured one of the longest and most complex internal conflicts in modern history.
We are, of course, exploring the Republic of Colombia.
A place that's defined by its staggering diversity, its 12,000-year history, and, you know, its constant, persistent struggle for peace.
Okay, so let's start unpacking that. The Republic of Colombia, or República de Colombia, even the name itself is kind of monumental.
It is. It comes from Christophorus Columbus in Latin.
Right. But the original idea for the name, it wasn't just for this one territory, was it?
No, not at all. When it was first conceived, the name Colombia was meant to refer to the entire New World, the whole shebang.
Wow. So that suggests a really foundational kind of epic identity right from the start.
And that foundation is first and foremost geographic. I think a lot of people see Colombia as just, you know, a South American country. But it's so much more. It's a continental hinge.
A crossroads.
A crossroads, exactly. While its main territory is in South America, it has insular regions, islands that actually extend all the way into North America.
And it has this unique position, being the only country in South America with coastlines on both the Caribbean Sea and the Pacific Ocean.
Which is a massive strategic advantage. And then it's bordered by five different countries. You've got Panama, Venezuela, Brazil, Peru, and Ecuador. It's right in the middle of everything.
And at the heart of it all is the capital, Bogota. Now, when you think of a big Latin American capital, you're probably picturing, you know, tropical heat, palm trees.
Not here.
Not here at all. Bogota is massive. It's the largest city. But it sits at a staggering elevation of 2,600 meters.
That's 8,530 feet.
It's just incredible. It's the highest major city of its size anywhere on the planet. It's a metropolis built literally in the high Andes.
And before we get into the deep history, let's just lock in the one central theme, the aha fact that you really need to hold on to for this entire deep dive.
Okay.
Colombia is one of the world's 17 megadiverse countries. And while it's second to Brazil in total species count, it has the highest level of biodiversity per square mile on Earth.
Okay, let's stop on that for a second because that's the crucial fact.
It is.
This country is seven times smaller than Brazil. Seven.
Mm.
Yet it have the densest concentration of life on the entire planet. It is an ecological treasure chest.
Absolutely. So that's the central question we're trying to figure out.
How does a nation so unbelievably rich in natural capital, maybe gold, emeralds, water, unique life forms, how does it also have such a long, tumultuous, and violent history?
That tension, that's the real story of Colombia. The tension between its phenomenal natural wealth and its profound internal conflict. That's what we're here to analyze.
So to even begin to solve that riddle, we have to go back, way, way back. We're talking about human settlement here as early as 12,000 BCE.
And it's important to understand, Colombia wasn't just a place for early civilization. In many ways, it was the corridor.
What do you mean by the corridor?
Well, its geography just positioned it perfectly. It was the crucial land bridge, the main pathway for human migration and cultural exchange flowing from Mesoamerica and the Caribbean down into the Andes and then east into the Amazon basin.
I see. So everyone had to pass through here.
Everyone. And we see the earliest evidence of this during the Paleo-Indian period. There are archaeological sites in the Magdalena Valley that date back as far as 18,000 to 8,000 BCE.
18 millennia. That's just an incredible depth of history. And it wasn't just about migration. Sophistication arrived pretty early, didn't it?
It did. You see a shift from simple migration to complex settlement. For example, at sites like San Jacinto, archaeologists found the oldest pottery ever discovered in the Americas.
The oldest in the entire hemisphere.
The entire hemisphere. dating to between 5,000 and 4,000 BCE. So this tells you they weren't just passing through. They were settled, they were agrarian, they were developing complex technology long before many other famous civilizations.
And these societies eventually grew into more formal political structures. The sources talk about Kesakazgos. What exactly were they?
Kesakazgos were essentially pyramidal political systems. Think of them as chiefdoms, led by a powerful chief or cacique. And by the first millennium BCE, you see these developing into major, highly specialized civilizations across the region.
So give us a sense of these early powers. Who are the major players?
Well, the most centralized and probably the best documented were the Muisca. They inhabited the high plateau around where Bogota is today, the Altiplano Cundiboyacense.
And what made their civilization so sophisticated?
Trade. They were incredibly specialized. They basically operated as the ancient financial engine for the whole northern Andes.
And what were they trading or their key assets?
High-value goods, gold, obviously, and emeralds. They had the best mines, but also finely woven blankets, coca, and crucially, rock salt.
Salt seems mundane to us, but back then.
It was everything. You needed it for preservation, for trade. Controlling the rock salt mines made the Muisca central to the entire economic network. They connected the mountain tribes with the lowland communities. They were the original gold and gemstone traders of the Andes.
So the Muisca were the powerhouse on the plateau. Who else was shaping this pre-colonial world?
Well, if you go further north, right near the Caribbean coast, you had the Tairona. They lived in the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta, a really isolated mountain range.
And they were known for?
Engineering. They were master builders, famous for their advanced city planning, building these incredible terrace systems into the mountainsides with complex stone paths connecting their settlements.
And what about in the west?
In the Midwestern region, in the Cauca River Valley, you had the Quimbaya. And they were renowned across the continent for their master craftsmanship, especially their gold work. Just stunning, highly stylized gold figures.
So you have this picture of a diverse, interconnected, and economically buzzing region long before any Europeans arrived.
Exactly. But here's a detail from the sources that just completely explodes the whole concept of regional isolation.
Okay.
There's compelling evidence of global pre-Columbian contact.
You mean beyond the Americas?
Yes. We're talking genetic and botanical evidence that suggests contact and gene flow between Malayo-Polynesians, so people from the Western Pacific Islands, and Native Americans right here in Colombia.
When was this supposed to have happened?
The evidence points to around the 1200s.
So people crossing the entire Pacific Ocean centuries before Columbus.
Precisely. And this trans-Pacific connection helps explain something that has puzzled botanists for a long time. The presence of coconuts in Colombia before the Spanish arrived.
Because coconuts aren't native to the Americas.
They're not. Their origin is traced back to the Philippines. So how did they get here? This theory suggests that this corridor wasn't just connecting North and South America. It was potentially a link in an ancient global trade network stretching all the way across the Pacific.
That completely changes the textbook narrative of pre-Columbian isolation.
It really does.
But
that global narrative, of course, changed dramatically with the arrival of the Europeans.
Alonso de Ojeda hits the Guajira Peninsula in 1499, and the Spanish pretty quickly realized the strategic value of that Caribbean coast.
And in 1510, Vasco Núñez de Balboa founded Santa María la Antigua del Darién. And that's significant because it holds the record as the first stable, continuously inhabited European settlement on the American continent.
So that coastal foothold was critical. But the real prize, as you said, was the Muisca gold in the interior.
That was the obsession. And that campaign was led by Gonzalo Jimenez de Quesada. He marched into the highlands and founded Santa Fe de Bogota in 1538, naming the entire region the New Kingdom of Granada.
And what was it that fueled this almost suicidal drive into the mountains? The sources all come back to one name, El Dorado.
El Dorado, the legend of the city of gold. But it wasn't really a city.
Right, it was a ritual, wasn't it?
It was a Muisca ritual. The legend says their chief would cover himself in gold dust and then dive into Lake Guatavita while his people threw gold and emeralds into the water as offerings.
So the promise of this just immense accessible wealth.
It created a gold rush that lasted for centuries. It attracted a flood of conquistadors, adventurers, explorers, not just from Spain, but from England, from Germany. It drove decades of often brutal exploration and, of course, exploitation.
And as the Spanish Empire formalized its control, this new kingdom of Granada grew in importance. Tell us about the viceroyalty.
So the Viceroyalty of New Granada was established in 1717. It was a massive administrative territory, basically an umbrella that covered what is now modern-day Venezuela, Ecuador, and Panama, in addition to Colombia.
So Bogota became a major center of power.
A key administrative hub. It was one of the three main centers of Spanish power in the New World, right up there with Lima and Mexico City.
And that prominent position put it directly in the crosshairs of other European powers, especially the British.
It certainly did. And that brings us to the Battle of Cartagena de Indias in 1739. This is an event that's often overlooked in global history, but it was absolutely pivotal for the Spanish Empire.
Why was it so important?
Because the British launched a massive expeditionary force to take the city of Cartagena. Their goal was to seize control of the main Caribbean trade route. And when I say massive, the British fleet was larger than the one used in the D-Day landings centuries later.
Wow. And they failed.
They failed spectacularly. The Spanish defenses, led by the brilliant Admiral Blas de Lezo, held them off. But the real killer for the British was tropical disease. Yellow fever and malaria just decimated their forces. It was a humiliating defeat for Britain and a decisive victory that secured Spanish dominance in the Caribbean for decades.
Let's talk about the colonial economy because it relied on two very different legal systems for labor.
Yes, and the sources draw a really crucial distinction here. For the heavy labor, especially on the coastal plantations and in the mines, Spain relied on enslaved Africans.
But the Spanish themselves didn't operate the slave trade directly, did they?
No, this is key. They used something called the asiento system.
What was that?
It was basically a government contract, a license that Spain granted to merchants from other European nations, the Portuguese, the Dutch, and later the British, to supply enslaved people to the Spanish colonies.
So they outsourced it.
They outsourced the slave trade. And this meant that the flow of enslaved Africans into Colombia was tied to the economic and geopolitical shifts happening in Northern Europe. It adds another layer of complexity to the history of the diaspora there.
And how were indigenous people treated differently under the law?
Legally, they were considered direct subjects of the Spanish crown. This meant that, in theory, they couldn't be formally enslaved like Africans were.
And there were systems to protect them.
Yes, the crown established systems like resguardos. These were designated communal reserves where indigenous communities had land ownership and a degree of self-regulation. Of course, their populations were still decimated by conquest and disease, especially smallpox, but those who survived maintained a distinct legal status and land rights. And that system, remarkably, still exists today.
But beyond that legal status, we also see active resistance, especially from the African diaspora. The sources mention Palenque de San Basilio.
An incredible story. Palenque de San Basilio was a community founded by Cimarrones, or runaway slaves, in the hills.
A Maroon community.
Exactly. And after years of fighting against colonial forces, this community was officially recognized by a royal decree in 1713 as a free town.
So, a free black town in the middle of a slave society.
Yes. It's widely considered the first officially free town in the Americas. Just a powerful beacon of African autonomy and resilience.
This colonial system, though, couldn't last forever. The push for independence finally erupted on July 20th, 1810, with the Declaration of Independence.
A movement that was eventually led by two giants of Latin American history, Simon Bolivar, the great military visionary, and Francisco de Paula Santander, the key political organizer and thinker.
But that initial victory, it didn't lead to stability. It collapsed almost immediately into conflict.
It did. The period right after 1810 was so defined by political infighting that it earned the lasting nickname, Patria Boba.
The Foolish Fatherland.
The Foolish Fatherland. It's a brutally honest name.
And what was the core debate that was tearing them apart?
It was the classic clash between federalism and centralism. The Patriots just could not agree on how to organize the new state. Federalists wanted strong regional governments, while centralists, led by Bolivar, argued for a single, powerful, unified government based in Bogota.
So while they were fighting each other, Spain was regrouping.
Exactly. This internal civil war paralyzed the independence movement just as Spain, after defeating Napoleon, was preparing a massive and brutal reconquest.
And the final war for independence, when it did succeed, came at a staggering cost.
It was horrifying. King Ferdinand VII sent one of the largest expeditionary forces in Spanish history to retake the colonies. The Spanish resistance was finally defeated between 1822 and 1823, but the cost was immense. Historians estimate that between 12 and 20% of the pre-war population died.
A fifth of the population. That's a catastrophe.
It's an enormous human catastrophe. It destabilized the economy and the society for generations to come.
But out of that sacrifice came Bolivar's grand vision, Gran Colombia, formed in 1819.
Yes, Gran Colombia was his attempt to create a powerful continental counterweight to the United States and the European powers. It was a massive union. It included the territories of four modern nations, Colombia, Venezuela, Ecuador, and Panama, plus parts of Guyana and Brazil. It was an incredibly ambitious, almost utopian project.
But as history shows, it was an ambition that just wasn't sustainable.
It collapsed by 1830. The vast geographic distances, the deep-seated regional rivalries, the wounds from the war, and that same old centralist-federalist tension. It was all just too much for the new state to handle.
And after it fell apart, the territory we now call Colombia went through this whole identity crisis.
A whole series of name changes. It was called New Granada, then the Granadine Confederation, then the United States of Colombia, all reflecting this ongoing ideological battle over how centralized the country should be. It finally settled on the Republic of Colombia in 1886.
What's truly remarkable, though, is how early and how enduring those political divisions became. The sources point out that the liberal and conservative parties were founded in 1848 and 1849.
And they are two of the oldest surviving political parties in the entire Americas. That longevity is just incredible.
But as you said, it's a double-edged sword, that bipartisan divide, liberals wanting federalism and secularism, conservatives wanting centralism and a strong Catholic Church. It created a framework for politics, but it was also the engine for just devastating civil wars.
The most brutal of which came at the turn of the century, the Thousand Days War.
From 1899 to 1902.
A vicious conflict between the liberal and conservative factions that claimed somewhere between 100,000 and 180,000 lives. So if you look at this history, the Patria Boba, the Wars of Independence, the Thousand Days War, you see this clear, undeniable pattern of ideological division leading to immense, repeated internal violence. It's woven right into the fabric of the nation.
And that pattern of instability had immediate catastrophic external consequences right as the 20th century began.
Wow.
Let's talk about the secession of Panama.
The loss of Panama in 1903 was a deep and national trauma, and it was directly enabled by the United States.
This is all about the canal.
All about the canal.
Yeah.
After a French effort failed, the U.S., under President Theodore Roosevelt, was aggressively pushing to build it. When the Colombian Congress rejected the treaty the U.S. proposed, the U.S. simply turned around and supported the Panamanian rebels in their bid for independence.
So the chaos of the Thousand Days War, which had just ended, created this power vacuum that the U.S. just stepped in and exploited for its own strategic interests.
Precisely. Colombia lost one of its most important departments overnight. They didn't even formally recognize Panama's independence until 1921.
And only after the U.S. paid them.
Right, under the Thompson-Arusha Treaty, which included a payment of $25 million from the U.S. as a sort of redress for Roosevelt's actions. It was an acknowledgement, but the wound was deep.
Okay, so moving past these early territorial disputes, we hit what might be the most devastating chapter of 20th century Colombian history. La Violencia.
La Violencia, or the violence, was this period in the late 1940s and early 1950s. It was essentially a low-intensity, undeclared civil war between armed factions of the liberal and conservative parties.
And the spark that lit the fuse was an assassination.
The assassination of the hugely popular liberal presidential candidate, Jorge Eliester Gaitan, in Bogota on April 9th, 1948.
And that single event triggered the El Bogotazo riots.
Riots that destroyed the center of Bogota and then spread like wildfire across the country, transforming these regional political rivalries into outright civil war. It claimed at least 180,000 lives.
How was the scale of this violence so extreme? It's just a horrifying number.
It was because it was so deeply personal and localized. This wasn't just formal armies fighting. It was rural banditry, political cleansing of towns, brutal land disputes, all carried out by militias operating under the banner of one party or the other. It just tore the social fabric of the country to shreds.
And yet, in the middle of all this internal chaos, Colombia was the only Latin American nation to send troops to the Korean War as a U.S. ally.
Which is just a testament to its complex and often contradictory position during the Cold War.
The political response to La Violencia was the creation of the National Front from 1957 to 1974.
Right. This was an agreement between the liberal and conservative parties to just stop the killing by alternating the presidency for 16 years.
Which stabilized things, but how did that structure then lead to the next wave of violence?
Well, the National Front did stop the inter-party slaughter, but it was fundamentally an elitist pact. By guaranteeing shared power between just two parties, it locked out any third parties, any new political movements. It completely failed to address the deep social and economic inequalities that were really at the root of the conflict.
So it created a political vacuum.
The perfect ideological and organizational vacuum for the formal creation of the major leftist guerrilla groups, the FARC, the ELN, and the M19.
And this wasn't just a grassroots rebellion. The sources are really clear about the role of external actors.
That is critical context. In the early 1960s, driven by Cold War anti-communism, the U.S. government actively encouraged the Colombian military to attack these rural armed leftist militias.
So U.S. pressure basically formalized the conflict.
It transformed them from isolated armed peasant groups into formalized Marxist-Leninist anti-state guerrilla armies dedicated to seizing power through revolution. The conflict was internationalized almost from the very beginning.
And then starting in the mid-70s, a new element pours gasoline on the fire, the drug cartels.
That's when the conflict becomes truly asymmetric and multi-front. Cartels like the ones in Medellin and Cali became massive producers and exporters of cocaine, generating this immense untaxed wealth.
And that money financed everyone.
Everyone. The guerrillas used it to buy weapons and fund their cause. Right-wing paramilitary groups, often linked to wealthy landowners, and even, as the sources name, multinational corporations like Chiquita Brands, used it to finance their brutal counterinsurgency campaigns. And caught in the middle of these three armed groups, guerrillas, paramilitaries, and the state were the civilians who became the primary victims.
The conflict raged for decades. But the 1991 Constitution seems to be the first real institutional shift toward peace.
It was a huge step towards greater democratic inclusion. And then in the 21st century, you see this dual approach. President Álvaro Uribe from 2002 to 2010 focused heavily on military counterinsurgency, which did significantly weaken the FARC.
But the pivotal moment was the peace process under his successor, Juan Manuel Santos. And it wasn't a simple, clean process.
It was incredibly difficult. After years of negotiations in Havana, they finally reached an agreement with the FARC. But then, in a popular referendum in October 2016, the Colombian people voted to reject it.
They voted no, after all that.
They voted no. It was a massive shock to the government and the world. The main reason was that many voters felt the deal was too lenient, that it let FARC commanders off too easily.
So how did they salvage it?
They had to pivot fast. Mm-hmm. A revised, tougher peace deal was quickly renegotiated, signed a month later, and then ratified by the Colombian Congress, bypassing a second public vote.
And for that hard-won, controversial achievement, President Santos won the Nobel Peace Prize.
He did. And as a core element of that deal, they created a unique justice mechanism.
The JEP, the Special Jurisdiction of Peace.
Exactly. Its job is to investigate and prosecute the most serious human rights violations from the conflict. But it operates under a system of restorative justice. Meaning, if former FARC members fully confess, tell the truth, and help compensate their victims, they can receive alternative penalties, like restricted liberty instead of long prison sentences. It's a system designed to prioritize truth and victim repair over pure punishment, all in the name of securing a lasting peace.
And this political landscape, scarred by conflict, it just continues to evolve.
The 2022 election was a historic turning point. The victory of Gustavo Petro, the country's first ever leftist president, and Francia Márquez, the first black vice president, signaled this profound desire for change.
A desire to finally address those inequalities that fueled the conflict in the first place.
Precisely. It showed a deepening democratic maturity, allowing for a peaceful electoral transition completely outside of that traditional conservative liberal elite.
And on the world stage, Colombia has very deep ties.
It's a powerhouse in regional and global organizations. It's in the UN, the WTO, the OECD. And significantly, it has this rare dual status of being both a NATO global partner and a major non-NATO ally of the United States. Its military is one of the largest and most professional in Latin America.
But despite the peace deal, the shadow of the drug trade and violence, it still lingers.
It does. Colombia remains a global center for illegal drug cultivation and trafficking. But we have to stress the massive security improvements. The homicide rate plummeted from a horrifying 84 per 100,000 people in 1991.
Which was one of the highest in the world.
Down to 24.4 per 100,000 by 2016. That is a truly massive reduction in violence, a 73% drop.
It's huge, but 24 per 100,000 is still globally very high. What's preventing it from dropping even further?
It's a problem of fragmentation. The big groups demobilized, But splinter groups and smaller criminal gangs have filled the vacuum in remote areas where the state is still weak. And there's a new complication.
For the crisis in Venezuela.
Yes. The massive influx of desperate Venezuelan refugees has unfortunately created a recruitment pool for these gangs. Some join just for survival, creating a new source of organized crime linked to the border.
So it's a country struggling to institutionalize peace while managing these intense external pressures and the legacy of its past, all while sitting on this phenomenal natural wealth.
Which brings us perfectly to the physical reality of Colombia.
Right. We've talked about its mega diversity, but we need to understand the physical engine that creates it. And the aha moment on terrain is that Colombia isn't one landscape. It has six distinct natural regions.
That geographical complexity is the absolute key to its biodiversity. You have the Andean region, the Pacific coastal region, the Caribbean coastal, the vast eastern plains called the Llanos, the Amazon rainforest, and the insular regions. It's a mosaic of extreme environments packed into one country.
And the spine of it all is the Andes Mountains. But they don't just run as a single chain through Colombia, do they?
No, they do something dramatic. After entering from the south, the Andes split into three massive parallel ranges called cordilleras.
So what are these three ranges?
You have the Cordillera Occidental, the western one, closest to the Pacific. Then the Cordillera Central, the backbone, which has many of the major volcanoes. And finally, the Cordillera Oriental, the eastern range, which is where Bogota is located.
And this triple mountain range fundamentally dictates where people live.
It does. The population is clustered in the fertile valleys and high plateaus between and within these mountains. It's why the eastern half of the country, the Amazon and the Llanos, which is over 50% of the landmass, contains less than 6% of the population. It's largely inaccessible.
And to add another layer of dynamism, Colombia sits right on the Ring of Fire.
Which makes it highly susceptible to volcanoes and earthquakes. It's a geologically active, constantly changing landscape.
So with these intense mountain chains, climate isn't about how close you are to the equator. It's all about altitude.
It's almost entirely about altitude. They call it thermal floors. You can basically travel from the tropics to the Arctic in a few hours just by climbing a mountain.
Most of the country is in the warm zone, right?
Right. About 82.5% of the country is below 1,000 meters with temperatures above 24 degrees C. That's the coasts and the lowlands.
But as you climb the Cordilleras,
the environment shifts completely. You move through the temperate zone, which is perfect for coffee, into the cold climate zone where Bogota sits. And then you hit the really unique high-altitude ecosystems.
Like the páramos. What are they and why are they so important?
Páramos are these treeless, high-altitude grasslands that are unique to the northern Andes. They're like giant sponges. Their special vegetation captures moisture from the clouds and regulates the water flow for the entire country.
So they're the source of the water.
They are the primary water source for almost all of Colombia's major cities. The health of the páramos is directly linked to the lifeblood of the nation's population centers.
And these diverse thermal floors and isolated mountain valleys, that's what creates the staggering biodiversity.
Let's go back to those numbers because they're just hard to process. 10% of the entire Earth's species.
In one country. And that number is probably an underestimate. It has the highest species density, the most species per square kilometer on the planet.
Okay, run through the rankings again. The one that gets me is birds.
Colombia is number one in the world for bird species, over 1,900 types. To put that in perspective for you, that one country has more bird species than North America and Europe combined.
That's insane.
It's also first in orchid species, and it's second in overall biodiversity, second in freshwater fish, second in amphibians. The list just goes on and on.
So it's an environmental superpower. Are they protecting this natural capital?
They're making significant efforts. Protected areas cover over 12% of the country, and compared to some of its neighbors, it has relatively low deforestation rates. Plus, it has the sixth largest supply of renewable freshwater in the world. It's a biological and hydrological giant. Which brings us to the economy that's built on that foundation. It's the third largest in South America, with a GDP over $1 trillion.
And it's an economy driven by strong domestic consumption. It's heavily urbanized, with the services sector making up the biggest piece of the pie.
But here's that core contradiction again. This massive economic success exists right alongside profound social challenges. Let's talk about the inequality.
This is the central problem of modern Colombia. The country has a Gini index of 54.8. And just to remind you, a high Gini number means high inequality.
And 54.8 is high.
It's really high. It places Colombia among the most unequal nations in the world. So despite all this wealth being generated, in 2017, the poverty rate was still nearly 27%.
So why does the wealth stay so concentrated at the top?
It's a complex legacy. It goes back to colonial-era land ownership patterns, and it's been made worse by the corruption and resource capture that happened in the conflict zones. The laws on the books might be strong, but in practice, especially in rural areas, they've historically favored elite control.
And the country's exports still rely heavily on that physical wealth.
Very much so. Energy and mining are huge. Coal and petroleum exports made up over 40% of all exports in 2020. And of course, emeralds. Colombia is the world's largest producer.
And in agriculture, it's a top five global producer of coffee, its most famous export, but also avocado and palm oil.
And it's worth noting on palm oil, which has a terrible environmental reputation elsewhere, the sources highlight that Colombian production is generally regarded as having some of the most sustainable practices in the world.
That connects back to their green energy efforts, like their reliance on hydroelectric power.
Exactly. Almost 70% of the nation's electricity comes from hydropower. It's a massive commitment to renewable energy.
And to connect all these economic centers, they're undertaking a huge infrastructure overhaul.
A $50 billion strategic goal. They have to tackle the massive logistical challenge of crossing those three mountain ranges. The plan is to build 7,000 kilometers of new roads and improve the railway system. The goal is to cut travel times by 30% and transport costs by 20%.
Now, let's pivot from logistics to pure innovation. Because Colombia is a surprisingly significant hub for scientific advancement, especially in medicine.
This is a part of the story that often gets completely overshadowed by the conflict narrative, but Colombian scientific contributions are globally profound.
Like what?
Well, for starters, the first external artificial pacemaker with internal electrodes was invented by a Colombian engineer, Jorge Reynolds Pombo.
I had no idea. And what about the technique used in LASIK surgery?
That's maybe the most impactful example, the microkeratome and the keratomalusis technique. These are the foundational surgical principles of modern LASIK. They were invented in Colombia. A technique developed there has fundamentally changed how vision correction is done all over the world.
So we've talked about the land and the economy. Let's turn to the people who inhabit this incredibly complex geography. 52 million people, the third most populous country in Latin America.
And a population that is overwhelmingly urban, over 77%. And that urbanization happened incredibly fast. Bogota went from 300,000 people in 1938 to around 8 million today. That's explosive growth.
And the ethnic tapestry reflects that long, complicated history we discussed.
It's a mix of native inhabitants, Spanish conquistadors, the African diaspora, and later immigrants from Europe and the Middle East. The 2018 census reported the population as about 87% mestizo white.
And there's a strong legacy from the indigenous population.
Absolutely. Over 80 distinct indigenous cultures remain, and their land rights are protected through that resguardo system. These reserves occupy a massive 27% of the entire country's territory.
In terms of language, it's obviously Spanish, but the diversity is still there.
It is. The Ethnologue database lists 101 languages still spoken in Colombia. That includes over 65 Amerindian languages. It's another testament to the country's cultural resilience.
Now let's get to the culture itself. The art, the music, the literature. This is where all those influences, native, Spanish, African, really come together.
In modern visual art, the giant is Fernando Botero. He's famous for his unique style, Boterismo, where he depicts people and figures in these exaggerated, voluminous forms.
But it's not just a caricature, is it?
No, he uses that volume to celebrate abundance and beauty, but also, very often, to deliver sharp political commentary.
But the greatest cultural export, arguably, is the literature.
Undeniably. Colombia is the home of the Nobel Prize winner Gabriel García Márquez. His masterpiece, 100 Years of Solitude, didn't just win him awards. It defined an entire literary genre, magical realism.
He used the fantastical to explain the real.
Exactly. He gave the world a language to understand the complex, often absurd, and deeply tragic realities of Latin American history and conflict.
And now let's talk about the heart of the culture, the music. It's called the Land of a Thousand Rhythms.
And that's not just a marketing slogan. They've officially cataloged 1,024 distinct folk rhythms. It's this incredible fusion of European melody, indigenous instruments like the gaita flutes, and powerful African drum rhythms.
The two big genres everyone should know are cumbia and vallenato.
Both from the Caribbean coast. Cumbia is built on this mesmerizing, steady rhythm. Vallenato is driven by three core instruments: a small drum, a scraped gyro-like instrument, and the accordion.
A German accordion, of all things.
Imported in the 19th century, and it became the heart and soul of the music. And then on the Pacific coast, the music is dominated by African heritage. Genres like kurulau are built on complex drum polyrhythms and the wooden marimba. The sound is completely different.
It's an auditory feast. No wonder a city like Cali has branded itself the new salsa capital of the world.
So let's try to synthesize this immense deep dive for you, the learner.
We have traced Colombia's story from a global corridor of civilization through the violent Spanish conquest fueled by the legend of El Dorado and into the profound political trauma of the 20th century.
We saw that pattern of conflict driven by deep ideological division and extreme inequality, which mutated into the decades-long asymmetric war fueled by drug money.
And yet we also highlighted this remarkable political resilience, the landmark 2016 peace deal, the creation of the JEP, and the recent historic peaceful shift to the country's first leftist president.
And wrapped around this entire human drama is the astonishing natural reality. Colombia's status as a megadiverse country leading the world in species density, a nation that is simultaneously a hub for medical innovation and a land of Nobel-winning literature and 1,000 rhythms.
We've painted this picture of immense natural and intellectual capital. But this is where the central tension of our deep dive returns, and this is the final provocative thought we want to leave with you.
Given Colombia's status as a world leader in biodiversity, the highest per square mile, and its deep history of scientific innovation and cultural genius, how can a country so incredibly rich in both natural resources and intellectual capacity simultaneously possess such high levels of internal inequality, with a Gini index of 54.8, and still struggle with ongoing internal conflict rooted in resource exploitation?
What fundamentally is the relationship between this vast, largely untapped natural wealth and its persistent, profound social challenges? Does the wealth itself in some way attract the instability?
That's the challenge. That's the deep dive.
We'll see you next time.